Hi, I'm Shirin Jafari. I'm a reporter for The World, where I often cover the Middle East. Recently, I've been on the ground covering the ongoing war in Ukraine. Take my recent coverage about Russia's strategy of targeting Ukraine's infrastructure using drone attacks, or my interview with Victoria Abidina, a young Ukrainian medic and mother who spent 6 months as a prisoner of war before finally being released earlier this fall. You may already know this, but it takes a lot of work to bring stories like this to you. Even a segment that's only a few minutes long is built on months, sometimes years, of establishing sources and building relationships. This work is crucial, and it's crucial that we do it well. But we can't do it without financial support from listeners like you. From now through December 31st, The World is participating in Newsmatch, a fundraising movement for nonprofit newsrooms like ours. We recently learned that a generous donor has offered to match gifts to The World before December 31st up to $67,000. But we need to raise that entire amount to unlock the match. We have a long way to go. I really hope you consider supporting our work so we can keep on bringing The World to you. You can learn more and donate at theworld.org/give. Thank you. And now, the show.
Support for this podcast comes from Wise, the universal account that lets you send, spend, and receive money internationally. With one account for over 50 currencies, who exactly is Wise made for? It's made for Austrians in Australia, South Africans in Sweden. It's made for New Delhi, New York, and even regular York. When you use Wise to manage your money across borders, you always get the mid-market exchange rate with no markups and no hidden fees. Join 13 million customers and learn how the Wise account could work for you at wise.com/world.
Big tech layoffs in the U.S. are hitting one community especially hard, people whose visas will expire if they lose their jobs.
To uproot, sell everything and move back to your home country, for any human, any individual, it's hard.
Also today, in Britain, new guidelines to help workers going through menopause. Flexible work hours, the guidelines also acknowledge how difficult menopause can be.
I didn't sleep at all for 18 months, and I genuinely mean at all.
And durum wheat, it's the basis of pasta and pita bread. A new version is engineered to handle drought better. The plant also looks pretty.
And it seems like something silly, but farmers do look a lot in what the varieties look like.
I'm Marco Werman, and the latest news and updates from the Men's World Cup in Qatar. We've got our first shootout. All that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. It's good to have you here this first Monday, the last month of the year. We start with a big policy shift in China today. Strict lockdowns in major Chinese cities are beginning to ease up in the wake of protests last week. The street rallies were born out of frustration with the so-called zero COVID approach to the pandemic, a signature policy of China's leader Xi Jinping. Chinese officials are now signaling that a new stage is coming. The World's Patrick Nguyen is following the news and joins us from Bangkok. What are we seeing now, Patrick, with the loosening up of these lockdowns? How are things changing?
Well, so far, it's a mix of different tweaks. So this weekend, we saw some adjustments to rules in big cities like Beijing and Shenzhen, where until recently, people had to show a recent negative COVID test to do just about anything, even getting on a bus or going to the park. That is easing up. There are also reports in certain cities about people getting sick, going to the hospital, and officials saying, just go home and ride it out. It's a pretty big deal. Previously in China, you'd be whisked away to a state facility for about 10 days. So lockdowns are not over countrywide by any means. You know, depending on the city or the neighborhood, people may be effectively stuck in place right now, but it does look like change is in the air.
What are Chinese officials saying about this apparent shift in policy?
China's top official overseeing COVID, Sun Chunlan, who is also the vice premier, she has said the country is ready for a new stage and mission. So that is the strongest phrasing from an official. There's also a new mantra being repeated over and over in state media, which is the virus is weakening, or Omicron actually isn't that strong anymore. And they're basically preparing people not to panic if they do get sick. We have to remember, Marco, that for a huge country, not many Chinese people have had COVID, because under this zero COVID policy, they have been locked in their apartment or their neighborhood. And this has saved lives. Only about 5,000 people have died in China, but of course, at a heavy economic and psychological cost.
The recent protests in Chinese cities seem to take a lot of people by surprise because that kind of thing mostly is rare, of course, in China. Does this policy shift suggest the protests worked?
Well, China's government is not admitting that. The U.S. State Department is boasting that the protest, quote unquote, worked, but that's probably just speculation. It is possible that the protests are speeding up a loosening of the rules that was already planned. So back in the summer, China switched to something called dynamic zero COVID, which means we're still trying to crush outbreaks swiftly with lockdowns, but with less intensity. So basically, everybody in China has an app assigning their personal risk level by color, green, yellow, or red. And if the government wants, it can make more people green, allowing them to travel to more places. So far, we see China operating within that strategy. The protests have not caused a wild policy shift by any means. In the words of one state-backed commentator in China, this is a major adjustment that has lifted people's moods.
So from a practical standpoint, Patrick, how prepared is China for the end of these lockdowns, especially when it comes to getting more people vaccinated?
Well, 90% of the population is vaccinated and half have had a booster shot. I think the big caveat is they're jabbed with these Chinese-made vaccines that aren't as effective against the Omicron strain. And right. The other big concern right now is for elderly people. So if you're looking at people 80 and up who are highly vulnerable, less than half have had their boosters. So the government now in December is doing a big drive to boost elderly folks using its apps and its big data and all of that. And that has actually been in the works for a while. That has not been caused by the protests. The government has wanted to get people boosted before Chinese New Year in late January, which is a time for families to get together with grandma and grandpa. So I think there's no getting around the fact that opening up will lead to more cases and more deaths. And there are these scary projections showing that if China just ended lockdowns abruptly, there would be up to 2 million deaths. But that's just if China opens up and lets it rip, which it doesn't appear to be doing.
So if Chinese vaccines are not so effective, could the government maybe try to import foreign vaccines?
Yeah, that's a question, Marco, people have been asking for a while. The answer is apparently no. So just 2 days ago, the U.S. National Intelligence Director, Avril Haines, came out and said, look, despite U.S. offers, Xi Jinping is firmly committed to not using Western vaccines. Now, there is a new Chinese-made mRNA vaccine, mRNA being the same technology used in Pfizer and Moderna vaccines. And it's made by a Chinese company called Walvax, but it's not cleared for use in China just yet. Interestingly enough, it did just get the green light to be used in Indonesia. So China will get to see how well it performs in another large Asian country before potentially using it back at home.
What about the longer term in China? Do you have a sense about when the government might do away with zero COVID altogether and begin to open up the country?
Yeah, well, the experts I've spoken to say the date to watch is March 2023. So the Communist Party right now is switching out some key leaders between now and then. It's a bit sensitive. And when they finish, but not before they finish, at a meeting in March, then some serious policy change is possible. And from there, it would roll out in stages, first opening up China domestically, opening what they call Tier 1 cities. So that's Beijing, Shanghai, Guangzhou. And then moving on to Tier 2 cities. And then if that goes okay, eventually letting in foreigners. But the thing is, you know, if outbreaks get out of hand in certain regions in the meantime, as they do this, they will still be able to quickly lock them down. And that's what this data-driven dynamic zero COVID strategy is all about. And I think it will be a very long, long time before they officially get rid of that tool.
The world's Asia correspondent, Patrick Nguyen, thanks very much.
Thank you, Marco.
The 2022 Men's World Cup hit the knockout stage in Qatar this weekend. Win or go home. Earlier today, Japan and Croatia played to a 1-1 tie after regulation and overtime. The match went to a shootout, penalty kicks, where the Japanese players struggled to find the back of the net.
Vasalic with a chance here. Everyone waiting, ready to win it. Goal! Croatia wins!
And Croatia took advantage. Lots of excitement in Qatar. The world's Bianca Hillier is here to fill us in. Hey, Bianca.
Hey, Marco.
So a lot happened over the weekend as the round of 16 got underway. Who grabbed the spotlight?
It's always going to be Lionel Messi when he's on the pitch. He's one to watch, and he hit another milestone this Saturday. The Argentina-Australia match was Messi's 1,000th game, wow. And in it, he scored his 789th goal. And it's easy to believe that's one of the best game-to-goal ratios in the sport. So Argentine fans around the world are happy, as are England supporters. They beat Senegal yesterday 3-0, and that was without one of their star forwards, Raheem Sterling.
Yeah, what happened to Sterling?
He's not injured. He had to leave Qatar unexpectedly over the weekend after his family's home was reportedly broken into back in England. Surrey police said in a statement today they received a report on Saturday night that a number of items of jewelry, including watches, had been stolen. Police say Sterling's family was not home at the time of the incident, and there's no threat of violence to the public right now. But still, you know, Sterling has kids, and he flew back to England to be with them and the rest of his family. Team manager Gareth Southgate said he's not sure if Sterling will come back to Qatar to finish out the tournament.
I really don't know, because at the moment it's a situation that he needs time with his family to deal with, and I don't want to put him under any pressure with that. Sometimes football isn't the most important thing, and family should come first.
And the next time England is scheduled to play is this Friday in a really crucial quarterfinal matchup against France. So we'll just have to wait and see if Sterling is back on the pitch or not.
Yeah, I hope everything's okay with Raheem Sterling and his family. There is so much that happens in a game, Bianca. Every single touch has drama embedded in it. And a World Cup just can't be summed up by the final score. Which teams had a good tournament this year, even if they are not advancing to the next round?
Yeah, Marco, that is so true. And this time around, African teams have really shined in Qatar. Five teams from the continent started the tournament and won 7 games in total. That's the most wins of any World Cup. And these teams are also making it further than they have in a while. So back in 2018, no teams from Africa made it beyond the group stage. And this time around, 2 teams made it, Senegal and Morocco. And the continent's hopes now lie with Morocco, who play Spain tomorrow.
Yeah, that's going to be a match to watch for sure. Let me go back to another game you just talked about, Croatia beating Japan in a shootout today. How big of a deal was that?
This was a really crucial matchup for both teams. Croatia made it to the finals back in 2018, so they were, by some metrics, the favorite here. But Japan has been really playing well all tournament, and they were strong again today on the field. And that success is part of this larger trend we're seeing from a number of Asian teams this year. 6 teams from the Asian Football Confederation qualified for the World Cup. That's the most they've brought to the table ever. And 3 of them made it to this knockout round. That's Japan, South Korea, and Australia, which is part of the Asian Football Confederation. So just because they aren't advancing any further doesn't mean they haven't had a great run in Qatar.
Yeah, no, totally. Big progress there. What about off the pitch, Bianca? What are people talking about in between games?
Over the weekend, news broke that had a lot of people talking about a former World Cup star. Reports that Pelé, the Brazilian forward who's widely regarded as the best footballer of all time, was taken to the hospital in Sao Paulo. And he's currently undergoing chemotherapy after having a colon tumor removed last year. And over the weekend, local media said that Pelé's health had worsened and he was entering end-of-life care. But in an interview on Globo TV last night, Pelé's family clarified that the soccer great is actually in the hospital right now because he recently had COVID and is now fighting a lung infection in a, quote, normal room, not the ICU.
Como eu mexo muito na rede social, eu tô vendo um monte de pessoal falando,
That's grandson Arthur Arantes do Nascimento. And he said that he's seeing people on social media saying, rest in peace, Pelé, and he wants to correct them. He says he knows the time will come one day, but it's not today. And Pelé himself said in a statement on Instagram that he's staying strong and he's cheering on Brazil at the World Cup.
Yeah, well, 3 World Cup trophies for Brazil thanks to Pelé. He is strong. We're still thinking of you, though, Pelé. The world's Bianca Hillier filling us in on the World Cup as the final 16 teams slowly get eliminated from the tournament. The plots thicken. Bianca, thanks a lot.
Of course. Thank you, Marco.
That famous end-of-year ritual, the word of the year. Here in the U.S., the Merriam-Webster Dictionary selected gaslighting, manipulating someone psychologically to make them question their own sanity. In the U.K. today, Oxford Languages at Oxford University Press went with goblin mode. Caspar Gratwall, the president of Oxford Languages, explains it to the Times of London.
When you're sitting on your sofa in your pajamas with a bag of crisps and a pint of ice cream and it's 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
Yeah, you know, goblin mode. Switzerland also recently selected its words of the year. The country has four different languages, but three of the words meant the same thing. Shortage. Huh, I wonder what's on the minds of the Swiss. All right, coming right up, a potential breakthrough for a return to civilian rule in Sudan. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. In Sudan, there is now a possible path to democracy and away from military rule. As you may recall, last year the army there seized power in a coup. Now Sudan's military leaders have come to an agreement with the country's main pro-democracy group to hold elections. Many groups that have protested against military rule, however, are also signaling that they are opposed to this new agreement. Khulud Hayer is following this. She's the director of Confluence Advisory, a Sudanese think tank based in Khartoum, and joins us today from London. Khulud, what are the top things we need to know about this agreement between the military government of Sudan and the FFC, the main pro-democracy group there? What does this agreement stipulate?
So the agreement is broken up into different areas. The first stipulates an understanding that Sudan is multicultural, multi-ethnic, multi-religious. It then moves on to talking about reform of the security sector and the constitution-making process. Then it moves on to speak about transitional authorities and structures, which is key here because this is the first agreement that stipulates that all governmental structures should be civilian and not enshrine a power-sharing structure that involves also a military component. And the fourth and last section talks about the regular bodies, as it stipulates, which relates to the military, rapid support forces, which are a paramilitary group, the police and the general intelligence services, which have been used by the regime since the coup to mete out a lot of state violence.
Why are some protesters opposing the agreement?
Well, the nature of the negotiation prior to the agreement did not exactly build trust between the protagonists of this deal and the broader Sudanese public. So, for example, the process was extremely opaque. On top of that, the resistance committees were not consulted during the negotiations process to ensure that their demands were then met through this deal. In addition, some of the armed groups that signed a deal with the former transitional government of Prime Minister Hamdok, and who later actually supported the coup, they have been pretty much iced out.
What are ordinary Sudanese citizens saying today about this agreement? Have you heard any reaction?
This time round, there's a much more sober response. A lot of people feel that we've been here before. You know, we've done this before. The civilians have made deals with the generals before, and those deals have not been honored. And so I think there's also some puzzlement as to why we're recreating that which hasn't worked before.
So externally and internally, there are forces that would like to move things quickly in Sudan. But if the only main pro-democracy group, the FSC, has signed on to this agreement, is that enough to propel things forward?
I don't think so. Frankly, the FFC of 2019, which signed the agreement that ushered in the first post-Bashir transition, is not the same FFC we have today. It's a much more diminished FFC. So they need broad political support from the street and from other political entities, more so today than they needed in 2019. Unfortunately, that's not where we are. The FFC will need to cultivate a lot more support from a diverse range of political entities across the country.
I mean, the headline of a transition out of military rule and into democracy feels positive, but where do you think things actually go from here?
What we're going to see now is a split between the generals. So we're going to have the sort of pro-Burhan, pro-Egyptian cohort with their own civilian constituency, and we're going to see the pro-Hemeti, pro-UAE cohort with their own civilian constituencies, and that's where the line in the sand will be drawn. And that doesn't exactly fill me with confidence that we're going to see stability.
Khulud Hayer is the director of Confluence Advisory, a Sudanese think tank based in Khartoum. She joined us today from London. Khulud, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
One in 10 people in Britain has quit a job because of symptoms from menopause. That's according to a leading women's rights charity in the UK. Britain's National Health Service, the NHS, is now trying to change that. Workers going through menopause will soon be entitled to more flexible working hours. But health campaigners say there's still a long way to go to raise awareness around these midlife changes. From London, our Europe correspondent Orla Barry has more.
Lauren Chirin from Glasgow in Scotland was in her early 40s when she began to feel out of sorts.
It just felt like I was walking through a treacle quite a lot of the time. I wasn't sleeping. Didn't sleep at all for 18 months, and I genuinely mean at all.
Chirin was working in financial services at the time as a senior executive. She had a big team and lots of responsibility. And she says she thought she was losing her mind.
I had this growing, creeping sense of anxiety, moods all over the place, and I thought something was really seriously wrong with my memory. I thought I had dementia.
Chirin left her six-figure salary job because, she tells me, she couldn't bear to be seen as weak or vulnerable. Over the next few weeks, she had a series of blood tests and scans. And one day she went back to her doctor to hear about the results.
I went back fully expecting to tell me how much longer I had to go before I'd have to find someone to look after my son, or, you know, find myself a home to rock away the rest of my life in. And he turned around and he goes, "You've just been through the menopause." And I just looked at him, tears running down my face, literally punched the air with joy.
Chirin was thrilled to discover that she did not, in fact, have early onset dementia, but was going through a hormonal change, one, she stresses, that affects half the population. The NHS says it hopes the new guidelines will raise more awareness about menopause. But the announcement comes at a particularly difficult time for the health service. Staff shortages are at a record high, and more than 7 million people are on waiting lists for treatment. News of the NHS menopause policy has sparked plenty of comment among talk show hosts in Britain.
Health professionals suffering menopause symptoms will be working from home and doing lighter duties. That's not going to help with the backlog of 7 million people waiting for treatment.
And I just worry that these sweeping sort of work from home orders could actually cause serious issues.
Next week, nurses in England, Wales and Northern Ireland are going on strike over pay, putting even greater pressure on the health system. It'll be the biggest walkout ever by British nurses. Holly Turner is a mental health nurse from Essex. She says they feel they have no choice.
No health workers want to go out on strike. Nobody wants to lose pay. Nobody wants to have concerns about what will happen to their patients. But this feels like a last resort.
Anne Turner says the huge number of unfilled jobs in the NHS is putting everyone, patients and nurses, at risk.
The vacancies are rising really rapidly. So we desperately need to recruit and we desperately need to retain our skilled and experienced staff.
The NHS says it hopes the new menopause guidelines will boost staff retention in the longer term. And the issue has also been raised at the EU level. But no country in Europe officially allows workers the right to menopause leave. Lauren Chirin never went back to her job in finance. She says she wanted to do something to prevent others from experiencing what she went through.
I've just spent the last 6 months thinking I will never work again, that I'll never be able to work again. I thought my life was over. And I thought in that minute, I was like, absolutely have to stop this from happening to anyone else. And for employers not to lose members of staff just through lack of knowledge.
Chirin developed a training programme for employers so they can understand the impact of menopause and come up with better policies. She now travels around the world, offering advice to companies and women's groups. But she says awareness varies hugely.
In Japan, for example, there's a beautiful word that talks about renewal and energy, and it's like moving into your second spring. In other parts of Asia, there are questions about what is menopause and does it really exist?
The UK government is now considering whether to include menopause as part of the Equality Act. This would mean employers would be obliged to support workers going through distressing symptoms. Lauren Chirin says this would be a major step forward. For The World, I'm Orla Barry in London.
You're with The World. In Iran, demonstrators up the ante, calling for 3 days of strikes. Shops across Iran are shutting down.
The protesters are mostly young revolutionaries and have nothing but their courage and grit.
What they don't have, experienced political leaders who can challenge the authoritarian regime in Tehran. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH and PRX. Picture the endless horizon of scrub and desert you've seen in Western movies. That's what Carnarvon, South Africa, looks like. Now add this to that picture, multi-story white TV satellite dishes, except that's not what they are. They're radio telescopes. Big hulking things, 64 of them in an array. They use radio waves to observe outer space. And in Carnarvon, a project to more than triple the number of these radio telescopes is underway. Jacob van den Einden is a research fellow from the Meerkat Research Group at Oxford University's Astrophysics Department. They use these radio telescopes for their research. First things first, Jacob, what exactly is a radio telescope?
So a radio telescope is basically a telescope that looks at light with a very specific wavelength. So if you think of normal light, the light that we can see with our eyes, that's what we call visible light. But if you go to light with much, much longer wavelengths, you get to what we call radio. And it's exactly the same waves that we actually use to send across radio signals on Earth. So if you're in your car or if you're listening to this on the radio, you're using exactly the same signals. But instead of observing these signals on Earth, we're looking at these signals coming from the universe.
And are those signals then converted into visuals? So we're actually seeing what's going on in deep space.
These dishes, these telescopes all collect this signal and we then digitize it into a computer. And then actually my job is to combine that and to make the beautiful images that you then end up seeing.
And Jacob, in your own work, what kinds of extraordinary things have you detected using radio telescopes?
So one thing that I study here in Oxford and that our research group also focuses on is something that we call jets, which is a process where a black hole is sucking up material that gets very close to it. And the sort of material streams towards the black hole. And just before it disappears into the black hole, it actually gets shut out into space around it. And it shoots these in what we call jets. So these are massive beams of material moving at almost the speed of light. And these light up very brightly in this radio light. So if you would look at them with your own eyes, you wouldn't actually see them. But if you look at them with a radio telescope, you can see this material very powerfully being blasted out into space.
That is mind-boggling. And as a kind of amateur photographer, I'm thinking that's really fast. I mean, is there kind of a parallel to shutter speeds with radio telescopes?
Yeah, there is. The shutter speed is actually incredibly slow. We usually need to observe for anything between, say, 10 minutes or maybe hours or days to actually collect enough light to make a beautiful picture. The nice thing, however, is that these things don't change very quickly. So if you take a picture every 10 minutes, you can still see these things move.
Wow.
It's not as if, you know, you're trying to take a picture of one of your kids and you know, your kid is just moving around and dancing around and it's very difficult to take a picture.
Now, this construction in Carnarvon in South Africa of a bigger radio telescope is part of a project called the Square Kilometer Array. What is that and what's the goal?
The Square Kilometer Array is a very old project, or the idea is very old, and it's basically to build the biggest radio telescope that we've ever built. So the square kilometer here refers to the original ideas of the collecting area. So you can think of that as the total size of all these dishes combined together. And the idea is to basically build the most sensitive radio telescope that we've ever built. And this is a massive international project. So in terms of collaboration between countries, it's a very beautiful project. The further away you look into the universe, the fainter objects appear to be. So basically, by making a bigger telescope, we can look back all the way to the start of the universe and the radio light that was really emitted at the start of the universe. And at the same time, we can also look at things close to us that just happen to be very faint and we couldn't see before.
Is the calculation with a large array of radio telescopes simply the more you have, the more viewing power, the more sensitivity you have?
So one part is that, as you say, you're basically making an eye that's much bigger than you had before. So you're literally collecting more light. At the same time, another thing that this does is that it creates more pairs of telescopes. And that sounds a bit strange, but in practice, how a radio telescope works is that you take two of these dishes, they're looking at the same thing, and you combine the data from these two dishes. And by now making more than three times as many as there were already in South Africa and making more than 100,000 tiny antennas in Australia, you create so many of these pairs of receivers, these pairs of telescopes, that you get amazing images as well. So you get sensitive images, but you also get very beautiful images.
It seems like once this project is done, you'll have close to 200 telescopes in array in Carnarvon, South Africa. What excites you the most about adding so many more telescopes down there?
There are so many things, actually. What for me is the most exciting part is one that's quite hard to define, actually, which is that whenever you build a more sensitive or a new or a better telescope in whatever way, you will always discover things that you had never thought about before. 30 years ago, we had not found a single planet around another star. And by now, we know thousands of planets around other stars. Mm. And I'm most excited, actually, for all the things that this observatory will discover that I currently have no idea about.
Jacob van den Einden is a research fellow from the Meerkat Research Group at Oxford University's Astrophysics Department. He's been telling us about what the new radio telescope construction in Carnarvon, South Africa, will mean for our understanding of outer space. Jacob, thanks very much for your time.
You're welcome.
There's been a slew of layoffs in big tech lately. 11,000 at Meta, 10,000 at Amazon, and of course at Twitter. It's not good news whenever anyone loses their job, but the tech workers who are in the U.S. on temporary H-1B visas, they face a double whammy. When they lose their jobs, they also lose their visas in 60 days. Rachel Miro of KQED in San Francisco reports.
All kinds of U.S. companies, tech companies in particular, use the temporary H-1B visa program to bring in people with specialized skills. Tens of thousands of foreign workers come to the U.S. every year on this visa, with many of them hoping to stay. Many start families, buy homes, and apply for the legal right to work here permanently.
We did sign up for this. When we come on work visas, we know what we're signing up for. It's not like, you know, things have changed on us.
That's Vidhi Agarwal of San Francisco, an H-1B visa holder herself, still employed, at the software company Databricks. She knows better than most that Indian nationals live in the U.S. under tenuous circumstances at best.
Before the mass layoffs, actually, there were silent layoffs happening at like a lot of companies. So we had a few acquaintances reach out to us to say, you know, this has happened and can you help?
Before the mass layoffs hit, Agarwal and a friend were running an informal database linking H-1B visa holders with prospective employers. After the mass layoffs, thousands surged onto sites like LinkedIn searching for help. In the last 2 weeks, she says, her off-hours project has exploded from roughly 50 friends and acquaintances to 500-plus nationwide. She's also in contact with about 100 hiring managers and recruiters because, after all, it is still a tight labor market, and they get that this moment in time is a good opportunity to sweep up talent.
You have kids here who've grown up here, and to uproot, sell everything and move back to your home country within 2 months. For any human, any individual, it's hard.
There are some protections for H-1B visa holders laid off. At the very least, employers have to notify federal immigration authorities and cover the cost of a plane flight back to the home country. Sophie Alcorn runs Alcorn Immigration Law in Mountain View, California, and writes about immigration for TechCrunch.
A lot of the laid-off tech workers have plenty of savings. They could find another job eventually, but getting through the holiday season plus the hiring freezes, it's going to be really hard to get an offer within the 60-day grace period that would allow the future employer to have enough prep time to get an H-1B ready for filing with the government.
Especially if that employer is also new to the immigration system.
So I've been advising people to try to get interviews as soon as possible, and if at all possible, try to accept an offer before the end of the first month of the H-1B grace period.
Of course, it wouldn't be Silicon Valley if an entrepreneur wasn't seizing upon this. Meet Abhishek Gutgutia of San Jose.
I'm an immigrant myself. I've been on H-1B visa in the past. So I know the pain points all too well, which also inspired me to start this venture.
The serial entrepreneur decided to set up a platform for immigrants that provides documents and legal tips for those keen to navigate the process on their own. Gutgutia calls his platform Zeno.
Zeno is meant to be that companion which helps you sleep at night with peace that, okay, someone's watching out for me and I'm not going to miss a key deadline.
One idea floating around, the Biden administration could extend the 60-day grace period for H-1B visa holders to, say, 180 days. When contacted, a spokesperson for the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services said that the agency continues to monitor the labor market and engage with stakeholders, but otherwise did not indicate any imminent change in policy. For The World, I'm Rachel Miro.
Activists in Iran have begun 3 days of strikes and demonstrations. Many shops in major cities are closed. The head of Iran's judiciary is blaming rioters for intimidating business owners and says protesters who have already been condemned to death will soon be executed. Unrest has gripped Iran since September. That's when a young woman, Mahsa Amini, died in police custody. To hear more about what's happening in Iran, we reached out to Ali Vaez. He directs the International Crisis Group's Iran Project. Ali, Iranian officials say they'll crack down even harder on these protests that have rocked Iran for nearly 3 months now. As far as you can tell, has this call for a general nationwide strike in Iran had much traction?
It's very difficult to say from a distance and from images that we see on internet. But the reality is there has been 3 months of sustained and persistent and determined protest in Iran. And we are in a situation that the regime's iron fist really has not been able to quell them. I think neither the regime is able to dislodge the people from the streets and prevent strikes, nor the protesters have been able to dislodge the Islamic Republic.
Aside from those facts, do you see any signs that the balance of power is actually shifting in Iran? Are the protests giving a boost to forces that might be interested in reform?
Not yet. And, you know, there is a sense after 25 years of repeated efforts at reforms that the supreme leader has repeatedly sabotaged and stymied, that the door to reform is closed. And I think there is now a widespread demand for fundamental political change within the Iranian society. The problem is there is no viable alternative to the regime internally, and the protesters are mostly young revolutionaries who are on the streets and have nothing but their courage and grit in facing a regime that is bereft of mercy. But they're not yet joined by the great part of the middle class, which is increasingly middle-aged and reluctant to face the regime in the streets. And as long as that dynamic does not change, that we have instead of tens of thousands, millions of people on the streets, it is unlikely that the regime will budge. And most importantly, it is unlikely that we see defections, which is the one thing that could potentially weaken the regime's hand at repressing the people.
Ali, I want to ask you for reaction to a vague statement made this weekend by Iran's attorney general. It's generated a lot of confusion, a statement about whether officials are indeed reigning in the country's so-called morality police. What do we know at this point?
It remains unclear. There was another official today that talked about the possibility of modernizing the way that they enforce the hijab rules. But, you know, the reality is that the morality police right now lies in ruins, and I think they would be unable to roll back what has happened in the past 3 months, which is that an increasing number of Iranian women are no longer complying by the rules and regulations of the dress code. That train has left the station. There's no way they can turn it back. And there might be a de facto loosening of the rules, regardless of what they say publicly. I think they can no longer effectively enforce that rule.
So this statement by the attorney general in Tehran, do you think it might have been a trial balloon of sorts set up by Iranian officials, or could it be a sign of internal divisions?
I think it's a sign of internal debate and also admittance to the fact that status quo ante is no longer restorable and enforceable. But the problem, I think, is more fundamental than that, that the regime believes that if it makes concessions, fundamental concessions on the ideological pillars of the Islamic Republic, of which hijab is one, it will be perceived by the population as a sign of weakness.
Ali Vaez directs the International Crisis Group's Iran Project. Thank you very much for being with us today, Ali.
My pleasure.
Over the weekend, the government in El Salvador sent thousands of troops to the city of Soyapango. This is from a highly produced video of the military deployment. It was posted on Twitter by El Salvador's president, Nayib Bukele. The video shows lines of soldiers, heavily armed, marching into the city of Soyapango. As the world's TBS Isaya reports, the move is part of a massive crackdown on criminal gangs.
March 27th of this year was the deadliest day in El Salvador's recent history. 62 people were murdered on that day by suspected gang members. In response, El Salvador's parliament approved an emergency rule that suspended some civil liberties, making it easier for the police to arrest people, restrict gatherings, and intercept communications by citizens.
Essentially, it's kind of a declaration of war against gangs. I mean, I think that's how you could really sum it up.
Norberto Ross is an anthropology professor at Vanderbilt University.
People look suspicious depending where they are. So if you're in a poor neighborhood in El Salvador that has high level of gang violence, then that makes you a prime target.
The new rule was initially set for just 30 days, but 8 months later, it's still in place. And it's allowed the government to conduct a massive crackdown on criminal gangs like the one in the city of Soyapango. It's one of the largest cities in the country and has a reputation for being a hub for gang activity. Brian Avelar, an independent journalist, was there when the military was sent in over the weekend. There are security forces in every street of the city, he says. Dozens of them.
Te están revisando a la gente. Ponen todos con las manos en el cuello, contra la pared.
Officers are stopping everyone attempting to leave the city, he says, asking them to take off their clothes to check if they have any gang tattoos. Norberto Ross says that's enough to land you in jail.
We know people have been incarcerated because they had tattoos, because they had loose clothes, because police thought it looks like a gang member. I mean, literally in the community I work in, women do not meet for coffee in the afternoon because it could be interpreted as an illicit gathering of people.
President Bukele says ordinary people have nothing to fear because this crackdown is aimed at criminals, not honest citizens. But Ross says that's not always the case.
There are a lot of people that have been incarcerated where I know for sure they are not gangs. Everyone is scared.
Bukele has been accused of human rights violations multiple times. In April, he threatened to stop feeding prisoners if the gangs didn't back down.
Y no me importa lo que digan los organismos internacionales, que vengan a proteger a nuestra gente.
I don't care what international organizations say, the president said. They should come here and protect the people. We'll be happy to give the gangs to you as a present if you want them, he said. Ross says Bukele's crackdown against criminal gangs is unprecedented and it's made him a very popular president. One public opinion poll taken in El Salvador over the summer found that close to 70% of responders support the government's crackdown on gangs. For The World, I'm Tibisa Isea.
It is used to make everything from pasta to pizza dough to pita bread. Durum wheat is a staple crop across many parts of the world, but with climate change and rising temperatures and drought, the tall grass is struggling. So scientists and farmers have created a new strain of wheat called Jabal, or mountain in Arabic. Filippo Bassi is in charge of the breeding project. He's a senior scientist at the International Center for Agricultural Research in the Dry Areas and is based in Rabat, Morocco. Philippe, tell us about this new breed of wheat. It was created by combining durum with a wild wheat from Syria. Is that correct?
Yes, durum wheat, Jabal, is a strain that we developed starting with a wild grass. It's called goat grass. It's called Speltoides, Agilopis speltoides. It was collected by our gene bank partners in the high plateaus of Syria. And then we brought it over. We combined it with something that is quite modern and highly performing. And we got a good hybrid that is really doing well and farmers enjoy having it in their fields.
What are the expected advantages of this new strain?
This Speltoides, this goat grass, really grows in places that are very arid and very hot. And because of that, it has developed a root system that is quite adapted to poor soils. And at the same time, as this pollen that is really tough and resistant to the high temperature. What we created is a variety that is standing some of the harshest conditions. You mentioned some, the climate change is bringing forth, such as drought and heat. On top of it, it looks very pretty. And it seems like something silly, but farmers do look a lot in what the varieties look like. And this one specifically has this rustic, strong look with a particularly black spike that really farmers enjoy. They coat their eyes. So it's a combination of beauty and strength that we're looking at.
Yeah, it is pretty remarkable and striking when you see it. It's kind of got this contrasting black fibers. Are there any things that were compromised with good old durum wheat? Like, what are we giving up?
Well, in reality, this variety is not great for making pasta per se, some of the products. It's in fact very good for making bread. I'm Italian of origin, and one of our traditional bread is called pane di Altamura, which is a very rich durum wheat bread that is yellow in color, very fragrant, lots of protein in it. That's what this variety is excellent for.
Yeah, so what does it taste like? I mean, we know durum has that unmistakable, slightly nutty quality. What does this Jabal wheat actually taste like once you've baked it?
So the bread is more crunchy than another type of bread made with another variety of durum wheat. It's a little bit more dense. The perfume itself, I don't know. I mean, I want to believe that they smell the mountain air, but course you don't. And then it has this, the color is an umbran color that is really like quite nice to look at. In terms of taste, I'm not an expert in this. It does have a taste of durum wheat bread, which for me is very good.
So, Filippo, I see the drought-resistant durum will be beta tested in Morocco, which is living through a serious drought at the moment. What's the expectation of how this new strain of durum wheat could improve Morocco's food security situation?
Well, first of all, you brought luck because today is the first rain in almost months that we're really seeing. So finally, this drought maybe over. We have witnessed almost four seasons of horrible droughts. And I mean, we're talking about most of the harvest being wiped out completely. So the advantage of this specific strain is that during these terrible years, it was actually doing fine.
Where else beyond Morocco could this variety be grown?
Well, Icarda is an international non-profit organization. So we develop what are called international public goods. What it means is that everything that we do is freely available to everybody around the world. So this specific variety has been provided to more than 50 countries, and people are using it for different reasons, rather as a variety itself or as a partner in their crossing. So trying to make their own variety better by combining with this one. Of course, it's not true everywhere, right? Especially I'm thinking about the United States of Canada. It survives very well the heat, but not the cold. So that's also somewhere that will not fit.
This project was supported by the Crop Trust, which is known for its seed vault up in the Arctic. Remind us, Filippo, why it's important to have a diversity of grain varieties, especially when the weather is going through so many extreme events.
It's incredible. I have the luck or the misfortune, if you want, to visit many of these places where climate change really hits. And you have pretty desperate people farming there, I have to be honest with you. I mean, some of these, you know, when you wipe away your entire farm, it's pretty saddening feeling. And they have tried many things. Probably the only thing they have not tried yet is this combination of wild relatives into the genetics, into the varieties. And so there's great hope that this will work. And the only way we can... We are looking at this stuff now, but our gene banks, you know, our seed vaults have been collecting them from almost a century, waiting for us to be ready to use them. The fact that we have gene banks that contain and maintain this diversity is fundamental to give us the time to be ready to use them.
Filippo Bassi is a senior scientist at the International Center for Agricultural Research in the Dry Areas. He joined us from Rabat, Morocco. Filippo, thanks very much for speaking with us about this new drought-resistant durum wheat. Really appreciate your time.
It was a big pleasure for me to be in the show.
Drought-tolerant crops are one solution to feeding the world reliably. In a world facing climate change, we also need to be thinking about how to grow crops that can retain their nutritional value. Here's the problem. More carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is expected to make some staple crops less nutritious. Experiments show that some rice and wheat lose about 10% of their protein when grown under elevated levels of carbon dioxide and nearly a third of their B vitamins. That's according to Christy Ibai, a professor at the University of Washington.
The projections under these higher concentrations of carbon dioxide suggest that hundreds of millions of people could be affected.
Zinc and iron levels in these staple crops also decreased by about 5% in experiments. Now, that change might sound small, but Ibai says the impacts could be significant.
The 5% reduction is really important because there's 2 billion people around the world who've got micronutrient deficiencies. And this is a factor that is just going to push more people over the edge.
That would mean more cases of anemia and stunting in children's growth. The nutritional changes would be felt most acutely in poorer populations who get more of their calories from starches like rice and wheat. Christy Ibai says experiments have so far only been conducted on a few varieties of crops exposed to higher levels of CO2, so it's possible that some cultivars would not be so impacted.
That research has not been done. There's a lot that needs to be understood so that effective approaches can be implemented to protect human health and well-being with higher concentrations of carbon dioxide.
Also, with more research, Ibai says, varieties of staple crops that retain their nutrient profiles in a warmer world could be bred. Here at The World, we try to spotlight positive stories across the globe. For an upcoming special edition of the show, we're looking at people helping others in hard times, and we would love to hear from you. Tell us about somebody who helped you when times are tough, how they made a difference in your life. Send us a voice memo, include your name, where you live, how you listen to The World, and tell us about that person who helped you. Record and send it to myworld@theworld.org. We might feature your story on the show. And that is where we leave you today. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you right back here tomorrow. Hi, Marco Werman here with a quick word before we go. Earlier, you heard from reporter Shirin Jafari. She was telling you how your contribution supports our international coverage, like her ongoing reporting on the war in Ukraine. If you value the coverage that Shirin brings, I hope you'll consider donating and bringing us one step closer to unlocking our $67,000 match. Learn more and donate at theworld.org/give. Thank you so much.